Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
Welcome back. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129. I am Carrie Weber, Executive Editor at America, and I am joined, as always, by Father Matt Malone, our Editor-in-Chief, and today by Father Eric Sundrup, an Associate Editor at America. And we've been talking a little bit about gene editing. We've been talking about trade and China and Korea and our upcoming conversation with Mark Singel, but for now, we're going to switch to the topic of a young Jesuit who was killed several years ago in Cambodia, who's now up for canonization. And this is, I found it an interesting story because it's very much a direct response to what we talked about a couple weeks back on the show, which is Pope Francis's decision to allow another pathway to canonization, which is that effort that when people are deliberately in put themselves in harm's way for others. Right. And in an ongoing and consistent way. And this is, it's a young Filipino Jesuit who was working as a missionary in Cambodia. His name was Richie Fernando. And he worked at a Jesuit vocational center. And in October of 96, there was a student there who was emotionally distraught. He brought this grenade to school. And Richie Fernando came up behind him to try to stop him. The grenade went off. And he basically used his body to shield the rest of the students. And in the process, he died. And I just found it a really moving reminder of the fact that people are still doing really powerful things for others, being men and women for others in really powerful ways today, and actively sort of becoming saints maybe in ways we don't expect when we often tend to put saints into boxes of long ago. I don't know.
And this was a... This is the result of a recent change by Pope Francis regarding the canonization process, the process by which the Church recognizes saints. Of course, the Church doesn't make saints. God makes saints. When we canonize someone, we are simply acknowledging what God has already done. And this is an interesting story. I actually remember hearing this story when I was in formation as a Jesuit, and I always thought that it was the most extraordinary thing. Particularly these words that he had written to a friend of his about his students just a few months before his death. He wrote, "I suddenly find myself feeling great love for them. If only I could follow Christ's ways, if only I could help all of them as God would, I hope I could offer my life to them to the fullest."
Yeah, I found, you know, I was interested of what you guys thought as Jesuits, you know, thinking, you know, this is one of your brother Jesuits. This is, you know, it's happening now. Is it particularly moving for you to kind of consider it in that context, or is it, you know, just as moving as anyone else who gives their life?
I mean, I think what you were highlighting, though, I think that's really important about it is the sense that, you know, this is, it happened in 96 of, I don't, where was I in 90? I was like grade school, but I
grade school? No, you were not. You were in high school.
Was I? Yeah, I was.
I was in high school. We're the same age.
I was the deputy director of a think tank.
but to think that, like, this, the story, when you hear about his other Jesuit friends writing stuff on the community board and talking about this in the real time, doing something that we would do to talk about something that had happened to someone else in formation, it brings that idea, it really breaks open that sense of, you know, because I read the stories of Francis Xavier and St. Ignatius and Peter Faber and Clay, and, like, you know, they're kind of in amber in history. And then this is a story about, and you can hear, and I imagine if you talk to some of the people, they talk about how he's a prankster. They talk about some of the jokes. There's probably a couple guys that were annoyed by him. Like, there's a humanity and a reality to this story that,
right.
I think that's a very hopeful thing. It reminds us, you know, if we respond as he did, you know, he says in that line, "I feel myself being called more and more and right. moving further in this." Then you're like, I should pay attention to that call as well.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And the beauty and the sorrow that can come from that.
I appreciated it on several levels, but two of which were, it reminded me, again, that, and this is not commonly known, that there have been more Jesuits killed or martyred, killed in the line of duty, as it were, since the Second Vatican Council than in the entire previous 300-year history of the Society of Jesus. And that's precisely because our response to the council was to go out into the world and to meet people where they are, particularly on the margins of society,
right,
which put people in harm's way. So I was reminded of that. That was very much on my mind and in my prayer. But the second thing was this sentence he utters, I suddenly find myself feeling great love for them. That really struck me because one of the joys of ministry is the spontaneous experience of love. Presiding at Mass or hearing confessions or
heading
preaching
up
from
an
the
editorial
pulpit,
meeting.
happens a little less frequently there.
Hey, wait a second.
No, I'm just teasing. But
no,
it is this. That's why I kind of trailed off. But is this? You are surprised by love. You find yourself just feeling this great affection for the people, and that's always a sign of God's grace. Any sign, any movement outward toward others that elicits in us the desire to give is always a sign that the Holy Spirit is at work within you, and that's a sure sign that the Spirit was at work in him. And speaking of the Holy Spirit, one of those marks of the Holy Spirit also is when we are able to be merciful and forgiving toward one another. And so the story that we have from Mark Zingel in the pages of America, the issue of America this week, is really a remarkable one.
Yeah, it really is. The article, as we mentioned, is called I Pardoned a Convict Who Killed Again, and Here's Why I Believe in Mercy. Mark Zingel, as we've mentioned, served as lieutenant governor and for a period of time acting governor in Pennsylvania from 87 to 95. And as we said, he's here now to speak with us. Mark Zingel, welcome to the show.
Why, thank you. I'm honored to be on the show.
We're honored to have you. Now, we gave a little bit of a summary of this story at the top of the hour, but I wonder if you could maybe set it up for our listeners and tell us a little bit of the narrative that you describe in your piece.
Well, the piece really begins when I was at kind of the apex of my political career. I had served in various capacities, a state senator, a lieutenant governor, actually acting governor in Pennsylvania because of a strange medical incident that occurred, and I found myself holding the pen for 6.5 months. And I was running on my own for the governorship in 1994 when a lightning bolt during the campaign struck really altered the course of not just my own political trajectory, but really Pennsylvania history in many ways. What occurred was that a decision that I had made as the chairman of the Board of Pardons to vote to free a person serving a life sentence came back to haunt us in a very bad way. The individual had, in fact, received a commutation. The board recommended to the governor. The governor signed the commutation. He was let out into the streets as opposed to being in a halfway house, and he committed a heinous crime in October of 1994, which just happened to be when I was in the thick of this campaign. So the opposition was able to take that incident and twist it into a very kind of potent political weapon, as in single coddles criminals, and you know, he's too weak on crime, and he voted to free somebody who went out and killed again. The reality is that there was truth to it, that I in fact had voted and made a judgment call to give this individual a second chance. And he went out and betrayed that public trust and committed rape and murder literally 30 days before the election. So it was just too compelling of a television ad. And my opponent used it to great skill. What happened was that, of course, lost the election largely because of that issue. But even Worse than that is that there was a reaction to that, predictably, that politicians ran from it. And they had a special session on crime, and they toughened the process by which criminals and prisoners could even be considered for mercy. And it, not just in Pennsylvania, but the narrative had some ripple effects that I think caused a real narrowing of the eyes. And we became a little bit less compassionate, a little less merciful as a result of that political incident. So I've kind of been thinking about this for the last 25 years or so, and given the context of politics today and the real ugly tone of political campaigning that we saw in the last election, and some of the unhinged comments and policies that are coming out that are driven not by compassion and courage, but by fear and hate, and it concerns me. And looking back on it, I've come to the conclusion that I did the right thing. I think if you err on the side of trust and faith and hope, sometimes you get it wrong. But the truth of the matter is that if you abandon those characteristics, the whole country is at risk. So after lo these many years, I look back and think, while that may have been the wrong call at the time, it's not appropriate, and it is extraordinarily dangerous to succumb to political responses to human tragedy. And so that's my message, and I'm sticking to it.
That's great. The I actually remember, Mr. Singel, I remember this story very well. At the time, before I entered the priesthood, I was working in Massachusetts for the Democratic nominee for governor, Mark Roosevelt. We were never 8 points up. We were never less than 20 points behind, actually. We didn't have a good year either. But I remember this story because also in Massachusetts, we had had a state trooper killed that same autumn. And all again, the body politic rose up, and there was a lot of rhetoric. Because it seems to me that politics can get really nasty when we're talking about issues of crime and punishment. That it's a pretty easy, there are pretty easy issues on which to demagogue.
It really is, and I don't mean to come off sounding holier than thou,
right,
particularly on this program, because I am certainly have my failings and flaws and so on, and I confess to you that I did that a bit myself. I mean, it's low-hanging fruit for a politician,
right,
to talk about three strikes and you're out, you know? One offense and we're going to get tough on you. Twice, we're watching you. Three, throw away the key. You know, it's not quite that easy. There are a number of considerations that have to factor into every single incident. And as human beings, we owe it to our fellow human beings to consider those. Unfortunately, the mindless rhetoric of the last generation of politicians or so lend themselves to bumper stickers, you know?
Right.
It's easy to say, no new taxes, lock them up, throw her in jail. Those kind of comments just cheapen the discourse so much, and they have long-term damaging effects on real human beings.
Right.
So it's important that politicians and voters check their guns at the door here and start listening to each other and opt for compassion and courage rather than hatred and fear.
And I should actually point out to our listeners that they can go to americamagazine.org and see a short documentary produced by America Films where you tell the story in greater depth. It's very well produced by Father Jeremy Zippel, who heads our film unit. And in that film, you actually say that, you know, what makes America great is our compassion, right? And I wonder if you could unpack that a bit for our listeners. Why is it important to have mercy and compassion in politics and in public policy?
Well, you know, again, without sounding moralistic, if you take a long view of history, the people that have moved the cause forward in this country are not the ones who decided to invade a country and expand our territory. That's easy to do. I mean, America, in my view, is not good because she's great. America is great because she's good. When we make the right calls, when we say we're going to figure out how to end child labor in our factories, you know, we're going to try to figure out a way to make sure after the Depression that people are at least going to be secure in their old age. Let's figure out some way to make sure that people get decent health care. Just recently, about two years ago, I was listening to a particular leading political leader who shall remain nameless in the thick of the debate over health care, who actually said, "Why should I be responsible for my neighbor's health care?"
Right.
And it hit me like a lightning bolt. I said, listen to what he's saying. This leader is contradicting 6,000 years of Judeo-Christian belief that we are our brother's keeper. And it's stunning to me that we have gotten to that point. So I very much believe that if we are short-sighted and thinking only about ourselves and thinking about how strong we are by virtue of the throw weight of our nuclear arsenals, then we've got a problem.
Right.
Then that means that we have turned a corner in America and we are heading down the path of every little tin horn dictatorship that values might above reason and sloganeering above clear thought. If we are losing the capacity to even think clearly, then we have a serious problem in this country. And I think we're heading in that direction.
Mr. Singel, you told very movingly about sort of the narrative of what happened after you made this decision and the repercussions of this decision to pardon a convicted murderer. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about how your faith played a role in that decision-making process for you, if it did. And then also perhaps how your faith helped you to deal with the consequences of that decision.
Well, in the article, I do make reference to my upbringing. I'm of the Byzantine Catholic rite variety of the Catholic Church, and I take great pride in that because it made me a little different, you know, whether I was in public school trying to explain the difference between the two rites and going back to 1054 and the Great Schism and things like that. I mean, we were brought up not just with Saint, you know, Patrick and you know, all of the Latin Rite saints, but Saint Chrysostom, for gosh sakes, and you know, that kind of Constantine and the Eastern Empire and things like that. So it was fascinating. It was a very really rich tradition to be brought up in, and as school children, we literally marched into church every day and sang the Divine Liturgy in Old Slavonic, a version of Russian. We literally spoke a version of Russian before we spoke English in terms of church prayers, so much so that I had a grandfather who would say in his broken English that when we prayed, we had to say the Our Father and the Hail Mary and all the prayers in Russian, because God didn't listen to English. So there was a part of me that you just, you know, it's part of your being, whether you realize it or not.
Right.
But the aspect of mercy was really pronounced, because in our particular brand of the Mass. There is ritual, litanies that recur, that have the celebrant father, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Calling for mercy, calling, making petition of God, and the response from the congregation is, Lord, have mercy.
Right.
You know, not make us smart, make us rich, but just have mercy on us.
Right.
And it's repeated about 100 times in the Slavonic, Slavic liturgy. When you're an altar boy, and when you hear that, and when that's drilled into you every single time you attend Mass, it tends to mean something. And you tend to think about that when moments occur later on in life. So when faced with the opportunity in a position of some power to turn your back on folks and just do the political thing, or to consider each case and exercise mercy, I really had no choice.
Right.
I just felt like there were too many ancestors and too many people going the whole way back to Constantinople that I was kind of required to do the right thing. That's how my brand of faith, my particular rite, had an impact on me. And I don't want to suggest that I'm any better than folks, because I'm not. I'm not a particularly saintly guy. I've had more than my share of sins over the years, but when it comes right down to it, I do believe that on balance there's more good in my soul than bad, and I further believe that there's more good than bad in most people.
Right.
And I think we need to recognize that, and we've got not to just slam the door on folks, even if the outward appearance looks like they are dangerous or criminal or antisocial or sociopaths. You never know. You know, there's some flicker there that needs to at least be acknowledged. And so I believed that when I took on the responsibilities of the Board of Pardons, and I may have mentioned in the article, I don't remember, when I was walking to one of the Board of Pardons meetings, one of my aides said, just vote no.
Right.
What you want to do, because you're thinking about running for governor, just make sure you go out and vote no on these folks, because they're not going to vote for you, and you can establish a tough record on crime. You know, I knew what he was saying. And I almost fired him on the spot,
right?
Because it's just wrong, you know. The constitutional duty you have is to preside over that board, and to me that implied considering each case on its own merits. So more than the rituals of my brand of Catholicism certainly shaped my character, no question. But more than that, my responsibilities, as I saw them as an American, as a Pennsylvanian, and as a student of history, required that as well.
Yeah, when you're talking about that experience of, you know, having that sense of mercy drilled into you by the liturgy and the setup there, I'm thinking back to what you were saying earlier, you know, sort of looking at what's going on right now, and we're lacking in compassion in a lot of different aspects of our public life right now. Would you have any advice about how we can foster more compassion? What habits or what behaviors we need to, you know, really get more of, so that we can experience this compassion more frequently?
Yeah, I'm really wrestling with that question because I have felt the need to speak out quite often over the last couple of years, and I don't have the forum. I'm not in an elected official capacity, and it frustrates me because there are so many things that strike me as being wrong or heading in the wrong direction, and cry out for somebody to have some moral leadership, and I don't hear much of it. I do not hear people objecting to what, in my view, is a cheapening of our American values and things like that. So I think, first of all, we need to be more aware of what our political leaders are actually saying. We were subjected to such a disruptive, mean-spirited campaign in 2016 that we've never seen this before, where at the level of presidential politics, you had candidates spewing venom at each other as opposed to talking about aspirations. And I will say that up until that election, there was at least some level of consideration for history and you know, the American process and the, you know, shining example of participatory democracy that we have. This went right into the gutter and stayed there the right whole time. And, it, you know, I was cringing, thinking, well, people aren't buying this. Surely they're not going to listen to this nonsense. You know, you can't stand up and ask people to vote for you to lead the greatest nation on the face of the earth by telling them it's all right to be bigoted. It's all right to be closed-minded. We're going to ignore the realities of environmental problems and things like that. Just all of your negatives. You know, I've never seen a campaign that focused directly on the lesser angels of our nature and win.
Right.
So it was jarring to me to watch folks just kind of buy into that nonsense. We got it wrong. We just got it wrong. And I apologize. I hope I'm not sounding too overly partisan. But it's not about a person or a particular candidate.
Right.
It's about the capacity of the American voters to separate fact from fiction and sloganeering from actual programming and aspirations from, you know, just attacking the opponent for effect. We've got to get beyond that. So the answer to your question is we, the people, have to do a better job of screening our candidates and insisting on a better quality of discourse and sorting out the utter nonsense from what are guiding principles. You know, I think America was founded on that kind of compassion, we've got to get back to it. That's all there is to it.
That is, you will find no argument with me on that front. The article is called "I Pardoned a Convict Who Killed Again. Here's Why I Still Believe in Mercy." It's by Mark Singel, and it is in the August 7th, 2017 issue of America. You can find that at americamagazine.org/pardon. Mr. Singel, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for sharing the story.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Of course. Take care. That is really a remarkable story.
It is. And I, you know, to be able to tell that story still, you know, and so passionately and compassionately for so long, I think is really a testament to how much he truly believes in this power of mercy and how in what he's saying and in the power of compassion and mercy to change our lives and our politics and our state.
Right. And I think that that's true. And to your point, Eric, one of the you said, you know, how can we actually cultivate mercy? One thing is we can pursue public policies that don't get in the way of exercising mercy when it is appropriate. You know, I know, I think I've shared on this program before, my brother was killed in a car accident when he was 16. His friend, who had had too much to drink, was driving, and he was charged with drunk driving and was going to go to jail until my father intervened and went before the judge and asked for leniency. You know, it said, well, there's no punishment the court could give that's greater than the knowledge that he had killed his friend. And the judge was lenient. And this guy went on to have a productive life with his family and his children in New England. But today in Massachusetts, the judge would have no discretion, right? Because, you know, we had we had this uproar, and you know, and then politicians stood up and said, "I'm going to get tough, and we're going to have mandatory minimum sentences, and you know, we're going to take this out of the hands of liberal judges and so forth." So that same kid today would go to jail, even if the victim's father was standing there saying that he didn't want that to happen, and that is wrong.
It's tragic.
Yeah.
It's.
Yeah.
What's stuck in my head is when Mr. Singh was saying, you know, he was praying about mercy all the time, and that change, it's that sense of how we pray changes how we believe,
right?
And that habitual movement of that,
yeah, and how we believe changes how we act.
Exactly. And so, you know, in this case where we're taking away the opportunities for us to put this into action and watch this happen, it that could be a very dangerous and vicious cycle for us.
Indeed. And I wonder whether sometimes politicians are in the same boat that the judges are, that right. the circumstances that surround them don't allow them to be the kinds of people that we'd like them to be, and that in their heart of hearts they really feel called to be. Yeah. So that is America This Week for this week. You can follow us online at americamagazine.org, where you can find all of the content that we talked about today, and you can see this incredible article by Mark Singel at americamagazine.org/pardon. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. And to subscribe to America, call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Carrie Weber and Father Eric Sundrup, I'm Matt Malone. Thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.